Hey, how's it going, guys? Welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. The show is libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Meaning, opposition to all of it. Mostly, I interview journalists and columnists and professors and lawyers and former CIA guys and crap like that. Today on the show, a columnist and a professor. the great Eric Margolies. He's a journalist, too. And we're going to be talking about a huge story that he broke back when that I think you'll agree is very important. And he'll also be catching us up to date on some Iraq war history. And then Stephen Zunis wrote this incredible thing under the auspices of he's describing how the Congress really sucks on Israel-Palestine, which is a huge story. It's a huge story. But in telling it, he's describing what they're refusing to acknowledge. You understand? And so it's 3,000 words of holy crap what the Israelis have done to the people of the Gaza Strip again. Holy man. Yeah, it's criminal, all right, and I don't give a damn what the actual law says, since they don't either. I'm just telling you what's right and wrong. There's no question about it. Stephen Zunis will be on the show to talk about that a little bit later. Man. All right. And chat room guys, if I start talking to him, just shut me up, man, because he's got more than 20 minutes worth of talking to do on the show about that article, so I'm going to really try my hardest to stay out of it. Margolies, I'm going to ask him about a few different things, really. So that's the show today. I was supposed to write up a blog entry about it. Today's show, Eric Margolies, spelled like Margolies, and Stephen Zunis, that's with a PH there. Everybody always says his name wrong. It's Zunis, man, not Zunes. What is he, some kind of new age hippie or something? It's a ethnic thing, some kind of Spanish or something, right? Zunis. Have a little respect. No, I'm just kidding. We're all just trying our best here. And then I got a ton of news for you. And I suck, man. I fell down on the job. I have about half of the Dick Cheney, Bill Kristol clips I want to play for you and talk about. But that might be enough to take up the rest of the show after the interviews anyway. Because there's a lot of it that you need to hear. And then I have so much to say about it all. Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. I'll try to pare it down. But I shouldn't say that. Because that always backfires on me. It's really some incredible stuff, though. Important for the historical record. Can I say it was widely unnoticed, this interview? I saw Matt Barganier tweeted it. Our good friend, the old editor of antiwar.com. But man, I read the whole thing, and I took a bunch of notes. I should have just stopped as soon as I proved to myself that, yeah, there's good stuff in here. I should have just stopped and watched it through and got my clips that way the first time through. Lesson learned again. But I went through and I got a whole bunch of the clips of Kristol interviewing Cheney, and yeah, it's just something else, man. Really something else. Alright, so there'll be some of that. And then also, I got wars to talk about. Lots of wars. First of all, let's get straight to the humanitarian sort of thing about this right here. On antiwar.com/blog, and in article form too, but most often on the blog, we reproduce the works of the great peace activist Kathy Kelly. She's from Voices in the Wilderness. And what she does is she just lives among the bombed. I mean, more or less. She's in Kabul now. But she, you know, I don't know what all work she does, but I know what always catches my attention is that she is always trying to draw our attention to, hey, look, an individual human being that you might have overlooked. Meet Imal, a 7-year-old Afghan student in the second grade. As he grew up, he kept asking his mother where his father was. His mother finally told Imal that his father had been killed by a drone when he was still a baby. And she goes on to say that if Imal were a white American kid, this tragedy would not have befallen his father. Which American would allow any U.S. citizen to be killed by a foreign drone? And then she goes on to talk about religious extremists in America and what if the Brits wanted to target them? And what if the Brits were flying drones over the United States, killing people, innocent people? We would kill them back as hard as we could. That's the American way. We would kill them even for looking at us funny. If they were actually bombing us, we'd nuke them off the face of the earth. A real aggressive war against the American people from, or well, I guess it depends. If they had an agreement with the Rick Perrys and the other governors of these states to go ahead and do it, I don't know. They could probably swing that. It's not a perfect metaphor. But the thing is, you know, they include a picture of this kid in Mall, and he looks like a white kid to me. Close enough for if that counts. I mean, is that what really counts of who has humanity and who doesn't have humanity? Who's arguing that in 2014? You might as well be arguing phrenology or astrology. What the hell does whiteness have to do with it anyway? But okay, let's accept the premise. You gotta be at least kinda white to have any right that any American government official is bound to respect. Well, this kid looks like any kid in your neighborhood. I don't know. He's got brown eyes, I guess. A little bit of a tan. Kind of funny looking teeth. He looks like a happy little first grade kid. I mean, what are you going to do? He's a human. That's the thing. And so the quote is, "My father was killed by a computer." In real life, that's what this kid is growing up knowing for a fact is true. Yeah, computer murdered my dad. It was a robot. Yeah, the Americans sent it. Not that he had done anything or anything. But anyway, I just like this. In fact, it's not even by Kathy Kelly. She just passed it on to us. But it's the same kind of thing that she would have written. And it's one of her associates here, Dr. Hakim, whoever that is. Some guy in Kabul. Life under American drones. And this is the kind of thing I keep trying to refer you to, this Washington Post article, that the whole first half of it is like, oh, boo-hoo, poor Israel has no choice. But then when you get to the second half of the article, it's all about what life, and, you know, they don't have a choice. You're going to write about life under drones in Gaza. It has to, for the Washington Post, of course the first half has to be all about boo-hoo, poor Israel, which is a lie. But anyway, then the whole second half of the article is, yeah, what's it like to be a first grader growing up in Gaza with a constant buzz of drones in the sky? And yeah, there is a good percentage chance that it will kill you. They kill people all the time. From the point of view of the others on the ground, there's no rhyme or reason to it. You don't have to be tied to Hamas to get assassinated by an Israeli drone. They do what they feel like. And they fly those things above the Gaza Strip all day, every day. It's just a maximum security prison. And the people who live there in... That's right. Terror. Terror. They're completely beside themselves. Little bitty kids with every kind of anxiety disorder that an American psychologist or psychiatrist could think of a name for. And the same thing, it's actually called a giant study called Life Under Drones, about all the kids in the Swat Valley in Pakistan too. Well, and hey, the men and the women too. The innocent civilians who live life under the buzz of murderous computers, as this boy says, all day long. What fun. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, yeah. I'm back. We're back. You're back. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hey, join up the chat room if you want. Got a few people in there. Hey, everybody. ScottHorton.org/chat. You can tweet me at Scott Horton Show if you want to tweet me. Again, I got Margulies and Zunis coming up on the show. Those names don't quite rhyme, really. All right, so now here's the part of the show where I talk about what I saw on Fox News this morning. There's a new poll out, and the new poll says that 78%, wow, that's a lot, 78% of Americans agree that America is on the wrong track. Now, well, there's no real track. I guess it's just some kind of metaphor, but things just don't seem right. Now, what do you call a number like 78%? The highest number I ever saw for that before, I think, was 71, and that's pretty damn high. That's some kind of super-duper plus majority, right? I mean, you got to say like 75% is a super-duper majority. 78, meh, I guess it's still the margin there, super-duper. But, all right. But nobody really agrees, or maybe some do, but there's a hell of a lot of disagreement about what's wrong. But so here's my theory of what's wrong. It's the empire. That's the whole thing about it. You know, Bill Clinton's foreign policy professor, Carol Quigley, he's the author of a book called The Theory of Civilizations. And in or the history of civilizations. And in his theory, world empire is the last stage of your civilization before it dies. Now, what you should do if you have a prosperous, limited constitutional republic is keep it. Because empire, as Chalmers Johnson put it, is nemesis. The destroyer of republics. And the destroyer of societies. And that's just how it goes. So that's the whole thing. Because we sort of kind of had a free republic, to a great degree, especially economically, and an era of peace since the 1860s was the last time there was wide-scale violence between, you know, San Diego and Bangor. And so there's so much wealth that our government can't afford to take over the world. Like the brain from the cartoon. Always wanted to do. But the problem is they can't really afford it. It seems like they can. But they're dragging us down. And just go down the list of consequences. I mean, you know, the fact that your local sheriff's deputy, instead of wearing blue or brown, is now dressed in black military-style fatigues, just as he drives his little patrol car around doing traffic duty all day. That is the legacy of the empire right in your face right there. The fact that unless you sit around cashing dividend checks from military-industrial complex corporations for a living all day, you're not doing as well as you were before, is in the greatest measure due to the world empire and the cost of the wars. Remember when George Bush said the wars would be free? Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz said the oil from Iraq will pay for the entire invasion, occupation, reconstruction of the country. People were shocked when they announced that the original bill was going to be $87 billion. For the just first few months of the occupation. Not 870 billion. Just 87 billion. People said, what? $87 billion. Well, of course, the bill for the Iraq war now is in the trillions and trillions. The thousands and thousands and thousands of billions of dollars. For that occupation. But they didn't raise your taxes for it. In fact, they even sent you rebate checks in the mail there in the first few years of the Iraq war. Remember that? Everybody gets $200 or $300 Keynesian stimulus check in their mailbox, and that'll stimulate the economy. Indeed. To make it seem free, to make it seem like that was your dividend for letting them kill the Iraqis. Smash their entire society to a million tiny bloody pieces, to be more accurate. But really what happened was George Bush entered into a conspiracy with Alan Greenspan, his government counterpart over there at the central bank, and they decided that they would just print all the money. That's what caused the boom. And you may not have felt that artificial boom. If you're not a homeowner, if you didn't have a bunch of money and these are those stocks of the, you know, preferred companies and whatever, you might not have even thought of the Bush years as some booming time, some roaring 20s or whatever. But it sure was to, you know, the people with the wealth, just like right now is too. All the stats are coming out saying everybody who's already super wealthy, they're making a killing right now. While everybody else is still down in the bust that came from the last boom. And the reason why we have these booms and busts, only the Austrian school economists explain it correctly. Not that I can say the name of their profession right, but anyway. The boom comes from all that new fake money, government money, bank credit expansion under the license of the U.S. government. The government prints up bonds, the banks buy the bonds with brand new money, and then they use the bonds as the basis to create even more new money, and then politically preferred sectors of the economy get the rush of all the new credit into their industries, and it distorts what the market would do. And then eventually the correction comes, and you learn all about it at Mises.org, or just search the Austrian school theory of the business cycle. And you don't have to agree with libertarians about anything. You don't have to agree with free market principles or free market analysis of anything. You could be you could be a hardcore communist, but there just still is no denying that this is what happens with inflation. You don't get every price inflate at 2 or 3 or 10% across the board. Very rarely does that happen. What happens is you get giant bubbles in some sectors, which seems like prosperity if you're in those sectors that leads to the collapse. And then just think of all the dislocation that comes. But anyway, I'm skipping over the real injury here, and that is what the soldiers themselves call the moral injury. And that is just America being at war for so long, where, as we talked about with Gene Healy yesterday, that this is really Obama's primary achievement, is he has made a permanent state of war the default, and any moment of peace would be the exception basically from now on. Permanent war. And we have had that perpetual war in the name of perpetual peace since the days of FDR. It's true. And proxy wars and a Cold War and a lot of that kind of thing. But still, this is different than the 80s and the 90s. This 21st century era of permanent war. And it's changed who we are, if you want to be collectivist about it. The popular spirit of our culture is just different. Living through a time of perpetual emergency, perpetual threat, perpetual orange alert, and homeland security troops running around pretending that there's about to be an attack on a bank. There's about to be an attack on a this. There's about to be an attack on a that. And and think about when the torture scandal broke and the Bush administration, instead of there being any accountability under law, they said, "You're damn right we torture people, we got to." And then half the population rallied around that. Oh, man.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org.
Aw, man. You know, I didn't hear the bumper music playing. Now I screwed up and I haven't got Eric on the line in time. I'm trying now. I need to do a better job of watching that clock. All right, well, now I can't get a hold of Eric Martin when he's got dang it. Well, maybe I'll get him on in 10 minutes. Anyway, well, so good. I can continue my rant then. So the Empire is corrupting the American people's spirits. Not everybody, but yeah, there's a lot of that. And just think of the partisan divide when, you know, libertarians look at the left and the right, and particularly the Republican and the Democratic parties, as not having a dime's worth of difference, two wings on the same bird of prey and all that. Just think of all the hard feelings between the left and the right that are amplified to absolute hatred by people for their own neighbors because they're fighting over issues that are of such importance. Life and death. War or not. Torture or not. You know, there are people who their families don't talk anymore. You know, I'm lucky. The places where I disagree with my parents, it's all stuff that I don't really care about. Welfare state stuff or whatever. But they're good on all the wars. They're good on torture. They're good on fair trials for the accused and anything that would really piss me off. You know, and I would win the argument with them anyway if I had to, if it was something like that. But there are some people who, you know, comes down to these things, especially just because of partisan loyalties. People who would have always, if it was Bill Clinton doing it, they would have said, oh my God, torture is barbarism, but it's George W. Bush, so it's fine. And changes who they are. Changes, you know, the course of their life. And I know that because I've had people say to me, God dang, man, I used to be horrible. And you really helped me let go of all that crap. Like I was married to being pro-war and pro-torture and all these right-wing nostrums and whatever. And then you told me that it was actually all right to just forget all that. And boy, do I feel better now. You know? Hey, I think that's Margalie's calling.
Is it?
Hell no. Some spam. They would have been interrupting my Margulies interview. These people. How do I block them all? How do I get an outgoing only line? That's what I need. Outgoing only. Anyway. And then, oh, the corruption in our economy. You know, we're talking in the chat room about the British influence in America, particularly through the Morgan Bank, as detailed by Carol Quigley. And, you know, really that's what got America into the two world wars is, you know, Lord Milner's kindergarten, the same group that renamed the British Empire the British Commonwealth after, I guess, sort of exhausting themselves killing South Africans. You know, they had major influence in New York and in Washington, D.C. through Colonel House and other agents of the Morgan Empire. And they're the ones who built up this thing. And then after World War II, and this is the way Rothbard tells it in Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy, that World War II was really a compromise between the Morgans and the Rockefellers, that the Morgans would get to have their... And in case you're not familiar, Rothbard is the ultimate super genius. He ain't no crank. He proves it. It was a compromise between the Morgans that they could have their war in Europe if the Rockefellers could have their war in the Pacific. And so they agreed to go ahead and get us into the thing. Then the Rockefellers and then quickly, not just them, but the whole new right of the, as Quigley defines it, the military-industrial complex money and all the people who cashed in on World War II and on Truman keeping America on a permanent war footing after World War II. That, you know, they grew up as a separate independent power and all that. But then to what end? They have absolutely corrupted the entire American economy. I mean, never even mind their corruption of the political system and the military-industrial complex control over Capitol Hill and what that means for, you know, the policy in every way. But we don't really have any idea what prices would be without the massive American military empire here at home and the huge distortions, trillions of dollars, you know, pushed hither and yon by politicians and their will instead of free people making their own free choices based on the prices of things. And never even mind all the opportunity costs, There's, you know, all the loss from what never was, from the most brilliant engineers and scientists working for Lockheed, working for Boeing, working in the basement of the Pentagon, designing ways to kill people instead of better distribute food. Or, you know, other fun ways to turn a profit helping people. Instead, they are just, you know, all science and research and academia and everything is completely diverted into this black hole of militarism. And, you know, that's why Nick Turse wrote a book called The Complex. He said the military-industrial complex, of course, even then Eisenhower wanted to call it the congressional complex, but he didn't want to make it sound like he thought the presidency should have more power at the expense of the legislature because of this problem, since he was the president giving the speech, so we cut that out. But Turse named his book The Complex because it's the everything complex. It's the military, industrial, scientific, academic, media, and entertainment, and every part of the economy complex, certainly banking included. But any old company, whether you make weapons or not, any old company is all, well, not all of them, but a great many of them have their priorities all screwed up. If they can get the contract to sell the tube socks to their state's guard, or if they can get the contract for the battery for the army or whatever, they'll divert all their attention into doing that instead of the other things they're supposed to be doing. And then, of course, as we all know, especially because of the heroic Chalmers Johnson, the last knight of the American Republic, who did the most to publicize the method here, Lockheed and Boeing and them, what they do is they will have a plane built out of parts from literally, sometimes, in some cases anyway, I wish I remember the exact case I'm thinking of now, there are cases where they literally have something made in all 435 House of Representatives congressional districts across America. Certainly their standard policy for Boeing, Raytheon, General Dynamics, Lockheed, or any of the rest of those guys is to have those things made in as many congressional districts as they possibly can so that they can just blackball every congressman. And, you know, congressmen are elected every 2 years, so, you know, in the House. And because senators count as congressmen too. But they're elected every 2 years, and so they're constantly running. And so the MIC constantly has them by the short ones. And so there you go. And then, yeah, I talked about the boom and the bust and the this and the that. And then, yeah, just how it's corrupted everything. You know, I'm of the opinion, I'm very opinionated, and I'm of the opinion that that damned George W. Bush just ruined everything with his pretend tough guy attitude. Oh, look what a tough guy I am. We know what disarmament looks like. You bring all your weapons to the parking lot and you lay them all out there and say, I confess, here it all is. And he hadn't done that, so we're going to invade into the dirt. You look at how tough I am. F. Saddam, we're taking him out. Oh, yeah, you're such a tough guy. And just ruined everything. Just got the entire... To me, growing up, the year 2000 was a huge thing. That odometer effect of the brave new possible future, man. And it's just been squandered on this murder. This fake terror war. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. So where's this Margulies you promised us, Horton, eh? That's what you're thinking to yourself. Where's this Margulies interview you said was going to happen, Scott? I don't know. I admit I called him a little bit late that last break, but I just was going to voicemail and... You know what? Sometimes these things happen. Don't worry. We still got plenty of show left. And maybe we'll get Eric Margulies on later. The reason why is because he wrote this article talking about how he broke the story of Reagan and Bush Sr. selling Saddam germ weapons. Mustard gas? Sarin? VX? Okay. Germ weapons. Wow, cool. I wonder what kind of germs. I can't wait to get Eric Margulies on the show to talk about Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush selling germ weapons to Saddam Hussein. That ought to be hilarious. The great Eric Margulies, that'll be, you know, coming up later on the show. Anyway, so yeah, that was my rant about what's wrong with America. It's the empire, man. It's distorting everything. It's making everything suck. If only the end of the Cold War era had taken place under the administrations of Dr. Ron Paul, who ran in 1988. Could have been him. He could have been succeeded in power by Vice President Harry Brown in 96. And then he would have helped us build that bridge to the 21st century. By the time he left in 2000, beginning of 2005, we would have gotten the century off on the right foot. Peace and freedom and open trade and endless renditions of President Brown's Statue of Liberty speech. "Hey, everybody in the world, listen up," he would say. "Here in America, we all believe in liberty. And here's what we mean by that." And then he would start talking for about 45 minutes or so. And then there would be new libertarians in the world every time he gave the damn speech. And then things would not be perfect at all. But they'd be better than a lot of what's happened instead. And yeah, that George W. Bush. Talk about narrow-minded and short-sighted. Well, if that's what you think we should do, Dick, can you imagine making that decision? Well, Dick Cheney sure seems like he's the authoritative source on this stuff. Better go along with him. Nah, he wanted to prove he was tougher than his dad. That's a good enough reason to ruin the entire century for everybody. Right? It seems like personal reasons. The best kind. Dick Cheney clips coming up on the show. I don't want to start them now because then I'll have to end them because after this segment we'll be talking with Stephen Zunis about Israel-Palestine and war crimes committed by the Israelis there most recently. Let me talk about this, man. I read a thing in Harper's. It's called Why We Lost in Iraq and Afghanistan. A general's account of the military's mistakes. Now, Daniel Bulger is a general still. I do not believe that he is retired here. I think he is, at the point of writing this, a 2-star general in the U.S. Army. He says, "I was never the overall commander in either Afghanistan or Iraq. You'll find me lower down the food chain, but high enough. I commanded a 1-star advisory team in Iraq in 2005 and 6, an army division, about 20,000 soldiers, in Baghdad in 2009 and 10, and a 3-star advisory organization in Afghanistan in 2011 through 13. I was present when key decisions were made, delayed, or avoided. I made, delayed, and avoided a few myself. I was on the ground a lot with small units as we patrolled and raided. Sometimes I was communicating with strategic headquarters in the morning and then grubbing through a village with a rifle platoon by sunset. Now and then, Iraqi and Afghan insurgents tried to kill me. By the enemy's hand, abetted by my ignorance, my arrogance, and the inexorable fortunes of war, I have lost 80 men and women under my charge, with more than 3 times that number wounded." Those deaths, yeah, I won't indulge him. Those are just the facts. So the point is, so here's this general, Bulger. And so I read the whole thing because somehow a friend sent me the PDF file of the whole damn thing. And I read it, and so it has a lot of, I guess, what you'd expect a general to write about. Okay, so here this guy's big enough to admit, I guess the surges didn't work. All sloganeering aside, we fought for years and years and years and years, and nothing we wanted to make happen happened. None of the changes we've made that we were trying to make are sticking. And I guess we did it wrong and this kind of thing. But here's what I didn't find. And now the guy's written a book. So maybe in the book we'll have some chapters that get into some things that just aren't in this article. But it was a big, long article. You know, I don't know. 8,000 words or something like that. Big, long Harper's article. And he goes on and on about how we, you know, again, like how generals talk. I don't paraphrase it very well, I guess. But we failed to take on the lesson, you know, so full of so much jargon. We failed to take on the lessons of, it was so easy to destroy Saddam's army. We could have stopped right there. In fact, interesting tidbit, he says General Jack Keane wanted to leave Iraq immediately rather than stay. That's interesting to me. If you don't know who that is, sorry, that's a discussion for another time. But if you do know that, if you do know who that is, that might be interesting to you too. Maybe you already knew that. I didn't. I'm surprised to find that out, actually. So he says, you know, it was so easy to whoop the Taliban and to whoop Saddam that we thought it would be easy to stay, too. We thought we could do what we wanted. We thought this and we thought that. And then our guys started getting blown up, and we had to realize, and it took us too long to change, that maybe what we need to do is get a different kind of truck than sending our guys out in aluminum Humvees to be exploded all day. We'll get them trucks with steel on the bottom. And then we'll, you know, do a little bit different tactical type this and that and what, and then that's it. So the article, in other words, to me is full of nothing, because here's what's not in it. A cast of characters. And yes, I would like to know about the generals. It would be interesting to hear from a general. Well, which general, other than Keane and that one situation that I mentioned there, tell me about all the different, Franks, he puts Franks in there with Keane. They wanted to go before everything exploded in their face and they had to take the rap for it. Better take the rap for leaving before it explodes than standing there while it explodes and having it explode on you. But then, so tell me more about Sanchez. Tell me more about Casey. Tell me more about Petraeus. Tell me more about the year 2005 and what happened with the El Salvador option and hiring the Bada Brigade to torture Sunnis to death with power drills. Tell me about the history of the war. Tell me about Abdul Aziz al-Hakim and how you were his servant. Tell me about that, General. And yet, that's not in there. It's not in there. I really, you know, I was thinking about it, and then I didn't expend the effort. But I really should try to get this guy on the show. I mean, what the hell? He's going to write an article for Harper's. Seems like he's opening himself up to conversation here. Hey, man, how about the fact that every time you fought Sauter, you were actually fighting for him in every other part of the war the whole time, including those very same days that you were fighting against his guys? What about that? Why didn't you just make Sauter the Ayatollah in the first place, since that's who you serve? Remember the lynching video of Saddam Hussein? They took him out of this, like, you know, white ceiling tiled fluorescent office building courtroom. And then they handed him over to the Mahdi army, who took him out to a barn and lynched him. No official state hanging for Saddam. The Onion said, yeah, they're going to dig him up and redo it with a big parade and red, white, and blue banners everywhere. Instead, they took him to a barn and lynched him. And the crowd chanted, Muqtada, Muqtada, Muqtada. Muqtada, Muqtada, Muqtada. Because Daniel Bulger is Muqtada al-Sadr's servant. That's why. He doesn't even talk anywhere in this article about who's who, whose side he's fighting on. If you go into a country with an oppressed majority and you overthrow the minority dictatorship and throw them out of power and declare a majority rules democracy, then what? He didn't talk about that. Why we lost in Iraq and Afghanistan? They didn't adapt to the right kind of trucks fast enough. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West, while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal as we knew it is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. Well, shoot. Welcome back to the show, everybody. I got more bad news. I can't get a hold of Stephen Zunis either. Eric Margolis, Stephen Zunis. Where are my guests today? Wow, Fox News showing people getting blown up to death in Kobani right there. God dang. Oh, no, that wasn't Kobani. That was in northern Iraq, the ISIS attacks on the Kurds up there. Well, nah, I want to get to ISIS news later because I still want to get Margolis back on the show and I want to talk about it with him. But yeah, there's so much to talk about with the goddamn war there. But anyway, you know what? Let's go ahead and do these Cheney clips. It's probably a good thing that I wasn't able to get all the ones from the Bill Kristol interview that I wanted to play for you. Because this is probably going to take up quite a bit of time here, now that I think about it. But anyway, so, yeah, here, let me get us started here with the first clip. This is, again, Bill Kristol interviewing Dick Cheney. And they're talking about... I forgot exactly how to set up this. It's troops to Saudi. Their decision to send troops to Saudi Arabia to thwart Saddam's invasion of Kuwait.
What about the Gulf? It seems to me that's something that also was taken for granted after the fact. Of course we were going to.
Oh, yeah, that was what I wanted to say about it. It's Kristol just asking the question. It's not even Cheney telling the story. It's Kristol asking the question, and... making note of the importance, how significant it was that they were putting troops on the ground in Saudi Arabia.
What about the Gulf? It seems to me that's something that also was taken for granted after the fact. Of course we were going to kick Saddam out of Kuwait. Of course we were going to send 500,000 troops over to Saudi Arabia, a nation that I think had never had foreign troops on its soil, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, talk a little bit about that. Where were you when you learned that Saddam had...
All right, so... that was the only reason I wanted to play that. Sorry, I screwed up the intro to that. That was the reason I wanted to play that clip. It's just, a little bit of a recognition from Bill Kristol of how important that became later, although, not that they ever get back to it, necessarily. And then, so now we're going to skip clip two and go to clip three, because here's the second allusion to, the troops in Saudi Arabia. From this interview, again, it's Bill Kristol interviewing Dick Cheney, and from last month, it's at conversationswithbillkristol.org, and here's Cheney's reference to the significance of putting American troops, as Bill Kristol just said, 500,000 of them in Saudi Arabia.
And then the king turned back to me after a couple of minutes, and he said, okay, we'll do it. But he had two...
Was that loud enough? Let me play it again with the beginning, not so mumbly.
And then the king turned back to me after a couple of minutes, and he said, okay, we'll do it. But he had two conditions. One, that you bring enough force to do it right, and you get it done. And secondly, that you'll leave when it's over with. And I committed, gave him my word on that basis. I knew that's what the president wanted to do anyway.
The president had already, in effect, authorized you to... Had said we were
willing to send troops. I was there to close the deal, in
effect. Yeah.
That's right. So that was the second condition of the King of Saudi Arabia, was you can't keep your troops here. And, of course, they found a way to alter the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further, etc. Got to enforce that no-fly zone somehow. And, of course, as Ron Paul loves to point out, and I like to... usually silently pat myself on the back a little bit. I think he got this quote from me because I wrote this great article about how right he was after he got in a big fight with Rudy Giuliani called, "For those interested in facts, they hate us for our foreign policy. And it begins with this great quote of Paul Wolfowitz talking about how important it was that we invade Iraq so that we could pull our troops out of Saudi Arabia that had done so much to help Osama bin Laden recruit his Al-Qaeda network against the United States. The troops in the Arabian Peninsula. And then according to Wolfowitz's theory, oh yeah, no, just moving all those troops up into Iraq and having them, preside over a civil war in which they very much helped participate in the killing of a million people. That'll set everything straight. Just as long as they're not in the Arabian Peninsula anymore. Right, Paul? Wolfowitz? And Ron Paul loves to use that Wolfowitz quote. That there's Wolfowitz even admitting that, of course, that was a big deal. So now, Crystal and Cheney both here sort of, you know, they open up the possibility they're going to get back to this subject at some point. What do the troops in Saudi Arabia have to do with anything anyway? But no, they never do. But just seemed important to me. And then this is important, too, just for the historical record, and I'll elaborate on it in a minute. This is clip 2. Saddam's gripe in 1990.
Saddam had been throwing his weight around. Right. The Iran-Iraq war had ended. Economically, he was in some difficulty. He had accused the Kuwaitis, for example, of undercutting the oil price, and that hurt him because he was almost totally dependent on oil revenues for his government. And he'd actually moved troops down to the Kuwaiti border.
Right.
And the advice we got from our friends in the area was, don't do anything to upset him. This is just a show of force. He's trying to negotiate a better deal on oil prices and so forth, and he'll never invade. And that's what we got from the region. At one point, the United Arab Emirates, in the run-up to the actual invasion, they were concerned, and they called and wanted...
Oh, I see. Actually, Zuna sent me a message. Delayed. For a few minutes. Available to... Oh, quarter after. Okay. Well, I better hurry. All right. Sorry. So, there you go. What was Saddam's gripe? The Iran-Iraq war was over. The Iran-Iraq war that George H.W. Bush, as vice president, was in the administration of Ronald Reagan, and I guess into his administration, too, supported Saddam Hussein against Iran. And so did Kuwait, and so did Saudi Arabia. Loaned him a bunch of money that he could use basically fighting their war for him. As the king of Saudi Arabia put it, it's in Chelsea Manning's heroically leaked State Department cables. The king warned, hey, it used to always be you, me, and Saddam against Iran. Why are we changing that? You're going to hand Iraq to Iran on a golden platter. When the whole game was Ronald Reagan backing Saddam's Sunni minority dictatorship in their massive million people dead killing war against Iran throughout the 1980s in order to contain that Iranian revolution. And then so Saddam was pissed, and we know about all this from the Glaspie memo. Saddam said to April Glaspie, the American ambassador, hey man, the Kuwaitis and the Saudis are completely breaking my balls here. All I'm trying to do is make enough money to pay them back. And yet not only are they overproducing beyond the OPEC quota and driving the price of oil so low I can't possibly pay them back and my entire country is falling apart, but at the same time, the Kuwaitis are overproducing from our shared oil deposits beneath the Iraq-Kuwait border, which is adding insult to injury, and they won't even talk to me. They made an appointment to talk to me and then they didn't show up. They're in Cairo having a good time, and I'm not worth their time. And then once and she says, Secretary of State Baker has instructed me to emphasize to you that we do not get involved in Arab-Arab affairs. We are not interested in your border dispute with Kuwait. And she says some pro forma stuff about, well, geez, you know, we'd hate to see any kind of violence. The whole thing, again, the entire Glaspie memo now finally leaked by Chelsea Manning. And so when Saddam invaded, and this is a clip I don't have, but Cheney explains, well, we were afraid he'd be able to move right into the Shiite part of Saudi Arabia where all the oil is, right there if we didn't stop him in Kuwait. And anyway, so just so you understand a little bit of the context of how America, in effect, baited Saddam into invading Kuwait in the first place. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Back to more of those clips from Bill Kristol's interview of Dick Cheney in just a little bit. But now we go to Stephen Zunis from Foreign Policy in Focus. That's FPIF.org. And here he is reprinted at original.antiwar.com/Zunis. Spelled like Zunes. That's how everybody says it when they say it wrong. He, of course, writes for Peace Voice and is a professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Again, FPIF.org for Foreign Policy in Focus. Welcome back. How are you doing, Stephen?
Great to be with you.
Very good to have you here. Very important piece that you've written. I do hope everyone will take a look at this, maybe help pass it around a bit. Because in context of talking about the legalities of the different, enforcement mechanisms of war crimes, this and that, in the context of the politics of the U.S. Congress, boy, do you sure tell a story of what the Israelis have done to the people of the Gaza Strip again.
And yeah, well, yeah,
it's
no,
really
that's
something else. And I don't know if you want to weave it all together so brilliantly like that out loud, or if you want to kind of break it into pieces and just catch people up on the facts first and before we get to the politics, or how you want to do it. But please go ahead. The floor is yours, sir.
Well, briefly, in 7 weeks of attacks on the crowded, besieged Gaza enclave, 1,500 Palestinian civilians were killed, along with several hundred Hamas fighters. More than 500 of those civilians were children. About 18,000 homes were destroyed, leaving over 100,000 people homeless. It was devastating. Hamas was, meanwhile, lobbing rockets into Israel. Fortunately, did not do anything close to the damage. Five civilians were killed on the Israeli side. But what's striking about all this is that while polls show most Americans either blame both sides or blame, believe Israel's primarily responsible, a bipartisan majority of Congress, huge majorities, have gone on record saying that Hamas was exclusively responsible and that Israel bore no responsibility, in effect, for the 1,500 civilians killed, which is quite remarkable. I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, Israel has a right to exist, that that Hamas shouldn't, lob rockets into Israel. Israel has a right to self-defense. I mean, yeah, that's all quite reasonable. But to deny well-documented war crimes, to make statements, as both parties did, that directly contradict findings by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, even Israeli human rights groups like B'Tselem, that documented apparent war crimes by the Israelis, to contradict findings by United Nations officials on the ground, by international journalists, for these guys in their air-conditioned offices in Washington, D.C. to say, oh, you guys don't know what you're talking about. We know what's going on in Gaza, and you should believe us, not what these, human rights groups say. The same human rights groups, of course, they easily quickly quote when they're talking about repression in Syria or repression in Iran, or repression in governments we don't like.
Course,
but when it comes to criticizing a strategic ally of the United States, oh, suddenly they're biased, suddenly you can't believe them, they're ignored, and the Congress will go out of their way to try to discredit them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they even, I think, as you write here, they sort of just, by definition, exclude the possibility that the Israelis could be responsible for the death even of anyone, I guess, even of the Hamas guys that they're targeting and killing, that those guys are all just basically committing suicide by cop. And anyone who happens to be nearby them, who also get killed, all of the responsibility just because of, words must belong to Hamas cannot belong to the IDF or their political leaders, period.
Exactly. Yeah. For one thing, Hamas, you know, the armed wing has engaged in acts of terrorism. Obviously, shooting random rockets in the civilian areas in Israel is illegal. It's a war crime. But basically, Israel said if you are any member of Hamas government, you know, if you work for a Hamas-run medical clinic, if you're, you know, the Hamas-run post office, you are a terrorist by definition, and you are a legitimate target, and so is everybody in your apartment block. Literally, this is how they've been trying to rationalize it. And then they say, oh, it's not Israel's fault because Hamas is using human shields. Well, human shields are defined as when you are holding civilians against their will as some kind of deterrent. And preliminary investigations by Human Rights Watch, by Amnesty International, by international journalists, have found no evidence that Hamas did this. Now, they have criticized Hamas, for storing weapons in unoccupied, UN school buildings, but that does not justify Israel attacking 6 UN school buildings that had refugees inside, you know, killing scores of innocent people after the UN specifically told the Israelis that these had refugees in them, that there's no Hamas military activity anywhere close, and even gave the coordinates of the specific schools, and they still attack them.
All right, now, hold on 1 second. And I'm sorry, because there's so much to cover here, but this is so important. What you say sounds unbelievable. Or even if, okay, maybe that happened, I don't know, I wasn't paying attention a few weeks ago when you say this took place, but it must have been an accident. 6 times, it must be Hamas's fault somehow. How in the world? Tell us this story. Explain what you mean that the Israelis attacked schools full of refugees on 6 different occasions.
There are 6 separate schools that were attacked by Israel. In 3 of them, there were fatalities totaling 46 civilians, including 10 UN staff members. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which runs the schools, had notified, you know, the Israelis of their exact locations, the absence of any Hamas military equipment or activity, and even gave the coordinates of where they were, saying, you know, saying that we got a lot of civilians here, because basically what the congressional resolution saying, oh, Israel doesn't have any responsibility for civilian deaths because they told Israel to leave areas that they were bombing. Well, a lot of civilians did leave these areas, and where do they seek refuge? In these schools. And what happens? They get bombed anyway. And so then Hamas said, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to flee because it might even increase your chances of getting attacked. So then Congress says, the Hamas is using human shields by telling people they should stay put when Israel told them to leave. I mean, you know, they're twisting all this, they're twisting this information to justify for these kinds of killings. Let me quote from some of these congressional resolutions.
Very quickly, this break is creeping on us here.
They're saying that a Senate resolution passed by unanimous consent claimed that the government of Israel has taken significant steps to protect civilians in Gaza. Israel's attacks have been focused on terrorist tactics. A House resolution: Israel goes to extraordinary lengths to target only terrorist actors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Stephen Zunis. Go to original.antiwar.com/Zunis for Gaza and the bipartisan war on human rights. 1 sec. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Stephen Zunis. And he wrote this great article for Foreign Policy and Focus. We're running on antiwar.com. Gaza and the Bipartisan War on Human Rights. And so we're talking about, and he's documenting with details here and citing his sources about the attacks on the UN schools as part of this story here. Congress saying, you know, everything that happens there is all Hamas's fault, and the Israelis, again, by definition, couldn't possibly do anything wrong. But so I wonder, though, if you could elaborate on, and maybe this is asking you to speculate, and you don't have to, or you can identify speculation as such if you want, or however you want to answer, but I wonder what you think is the motivation of attacking a bunch of schools full of refugees, because after all, we live in an age of Twitter, and, you know, these guys, they may be the last ones to find out, but they found out by now that, you know, hey, you guys look really bad. And people who used to like it are saying, come on, that's too many UN schools full of refugees to be an accident at this point. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, a bad guy might do, not our friends, the plucky little Israeli Democrats. What is going on here? And so I wonder what's more important for them to accomplish by doing such that it overrides the absolutely horrible public relations on a global scale for the state of Israel going forward, Stephen?
I think the main reason is they know they have the a superpower umbrella protecting them, that the United States will not eliminate or reduce the billions of dollars of military aid and other support we provide that government. The United
States.
Sure,
I mean, no doubt there will be no consequences, but so still, why do it? Just for the fun of it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know what motivates them. I haven't seen the evidence. They're deliberately just trying to kill children. But I think they're basically saying that, if you're fighting terrorism, that basically you don't have to worry about it. That if we can kill one terrorist, who cares if we, kill, dozens of other people in the process? There may be indeed be individual tank commanders or whatever who are, racist and extremist enough to get off on killing Palestinian children. I don't know, but, they take this idea that, if you're dealing with a ruthless group like, Hamas, there's no limits to what you can do. And what's rather frightening about this is, again, the language that the congressional resolutions have that are basically rewriting international humanitarian law to basically, to prove this, have implications far beyond Israel-Palestine. In fact, one of the House resolutions that was accusing Hamas of using human shields, therefore giving Israel a carte blanche to kill as many people as they wanted, claimed that ISIL was using human shields as well. Well, guess what? Within weeks, the United States started bombing Syrian and Iraqi cities. The implications there are rather disturbing. Actually, for that matter, you can justify Assad's regime slaughtering civilians in Syrian cities, as he's been doing for the past 3 years. They claim that Hezbollah used human shields back in 2006. What's interesting about that is that they had some detailed, not just preliminary reports as we've gotten so far regarding Gaza, but very detailed reports with top human rights investigators, forensics experts, and others who went into South Lebanon after the 2006 invasion. And again, we're very critical of Hezbollah on a whole number of marks, including, of course, sending missiles and killing civilians in Israel, but found that they found absolutely no evidence of human shields. Amnesty International said that. Human Rights Watch said that. Even a report from the U.S. Army War College said that. And yet, here's Congress completely rewriting history and saying that, Hezbollah, constantly used human shields. I mean, these guys, so it's not just a matter of a bias. These guys have a bias. It's not a bias for Israel. These guys have a bias against reality.
Yeah. even just that they're lying, too. They're lying about what words mean. So if you live in a tiny little urban prison and you dare to be in an urban place while you resist it all, then anyone nearby you in that close environment, you are using them as a shield. Well, I mean, no. As you said, we already know what that means in real life to use somebody as a human shield. And we can just type it into Google Images and see pictures of Israelis tying little Palestinian kids to the front of their trucks or marching them at gunpoint down the path like John Kerry in the Mekong Delta. that people can read about at Counterpunch. And so anyway, that's what a human shield is. Everybody knows that, but they just lie about what words mean in order to get away. They just redefine things and get away with it.
Yeah, exactly. There's all sorts of stuff they made up in there. They're saying that, for example, that Syria was training and supplying the Hamas, you know, with to attack Israel. Well, Hamas and Syria don't get along. In fact, they're enemies. Hamas is actually supporting armed Palestinian refugees in the Yarmouk refugee camp outside Damascus that are fighting the Syrian regime. The Syrians closed down their small diplomatic office they had in Damascus years ago. And yet, you know, here they have this, you know, Congress goes on record insisting that, oh, that none of that ever happened. In fact, Syria is actively training and making these attacks possible. I mean, it's just amazing that these folks, the lack of being so out of touch with reality for ideological purposes. And
let me ask
these were supported by the leadership of both parties. They were adopted by unanimous consent. Now, that doesn't literally mean unanimous. Technically, any member of the House or Senate could block these resolutions, but, you know, half the time they're snuck through and there's hardly anybody on the floor or anything like that. But the fact that they forced this, forces through without real debate, without a roll call vote, and done with the consent of both major parties, it just really shows how broad this consensus is. And what's also disturbing about me is that you had both liberal Democrats and libertarian Republicans who should know better, who should say to their leadership, "Hey, cut this out. This is ridiculous," and raise hell, were largely silent.
Yeah. Well, and now, I mean, and really, these resolutions don't do anything other than allow Congress to paint red targets on the American people, basically, right? I mean, it's not like, or is there something more specific about these resolutions, or they're just sort of blanket endorsements of Israeli behavior and denial of facts?
Yeah, they're non-binding sense of Congress, you know, kinds right. of things. But,
so they don't accomplish anything other than to just make sure that, like, yeah, you're right. It's America behind this. Don't forget it.
Yeah, and it makes Obama, who doesn't always act as a profile in courage in these sorts of matters. It makes it more difficult for the administration to speak out, even though there are some indications that they were actually fairly disturbed about what was going on. They just didn't do anything about it, and it also makes people in the Middle East. And Muslims around the world say, "Whoa, you know, here we have virtually, you know, the representatives of the people of the United States defending the killing of Arab and Muslim children." And that is not something that is going to make the United States look good, and is just the kind of excuse that you're going to have extremists and terrorists are going to use to end up attacking Americans.
Right. Well, and it has been, at least officially, and I know not everyone agrees on this, but at least the official story was that Robert Kennedy was killed by a guy who was angry about his work to guarantee the sale of Air Force jets to the Israelis. That was his gripe. And we've been suffering blowback on that very same issue, you know, maybe before, but certainly ever since then, including Mohammed Atta, who signed up to join Al-Qaeda after Operation Grapes of Wrath in southern Lebanon in 1996. And on it goes. But anyway, so now the music's playing, we got to go, and I know you got to go. But thank you very much for your time on the show, Stephen. Great to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
See ya. That's Stephen Zunis, everybody. Original.antiwar.com/Zunis. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. There's Stephen Zunis on Israeli war crimes against the people of Gaza. All right. So, I hope you're into it. I want to get back to these Cheney clips here. Oh, yeah, I have my notes. All right, so we talked about Crystal and Cheney both kind of obliquely referencing the importance of putting troops in Saudi Arabia, what that might mean for the future, although they never got back to it. And then we also talked about Cheney's version of Saddam's gripe, which was, of course, a fair gripe. I got a right to be hostile, man. My people are being persecuted. That's a direct quote from Saddam Hussein, in fact. So, anyway, it's Cheney paraphrasing him. But then he says, but, you know, we were advised by our friends in the region to don't freak him out by reacting or anything. He's just, you know, bluffing. But, of course, he doesn't talk at all about the option of doing something to resolve the problem. As the King of Saudi Arabia put it in the WikiLeaks cables, as he put it to Bush's son, the president, 8 years later, you know, 10 years later, he said, again, why would you give Iraq to Iran on a golden platter? It was always you, me, and Saddam against Iran since 1980, right? What the hell are we talking about here? And what they could have said was, hey, Saddam, Saudi, Qatar, Kuwait, we're the Americans, and we insist that you guys work this out. Kuwait, quit overproducing from y'all's shared oil wells, adding insult to injury. Saddam, hey man, we love you, dude. You've done great work slaughtering Iranians with chemical weapons for 8 years for us. But please don't invade Kuwait, because that would really, really bother us. Same time, hey Saudis, you guys need to be cool on the quotas, and let's let the price go up a nickel and let Saddam pay back some of these loans, and we'll all be in nice little offshore balanced kind of friends again. Instead of making the slightest effort to resolve it. They told Saddam, oh, we don't care what you do. Oh, Kuwait? Yeah, we're not interested in your border dispute with Kuwait. Greg Palast basically paraphrases James Baker as giving Saddam permission to go ahead and kneecap him. Oh, they're overproducing from your shared well? By all means, hurt them. Those are the rules. You don't do that or you get hurt. But he wasn't supposed to invade the whole damn country and got a little carried away. And then even then, Cheney says he argued for the war, but there were some in the administration. I think he means Baker, his best buddy in the whole world, as he explains in this interview. I said, who cares, you know, really. And Cheney said, well, now he's in striking distance of Saudi's oil, and so that would be a problem, so preemptive war there. Not that we care about Kuwait, but now he's too close to being able to get at the Saudis' oil, which would give him whatever percentage that I'm sure he overestimates. But then, of course, Margaret Thatcher called Bush a woman on TV, Bush Sr. She said, don't go all wobbly on me, Bush. And so, oh no, he'd already been called a wimp so many times, that was it. We're lucky he didn't nuke Baghdad. So it was on then. But at first, yeah, you know, it's not that they really lured him into it so that they could have the war. But in effect, that's how it worked out. But now, so we covered all that. Now, here comes clips 4 and 5. Oh, no, clip 4 is Dick Cheney, the one world commie. And yes, I say that tongue-in-cheek because, of course, he's a right-wing nationalist and hates the UN. Except in this case, it's useful. So, behold, Dick Cheney say the Constitution was irrelevant because the UN Security Council vote gave George H.W. Bush all the authority he needed to go to war against Saddam Hussein because, as he says, the treaty power... I guess I should review it at the end of the clip. Here's Dick Cheney, the one world commie.
One last thing about that period... I can't remember, when the decision was made to go to Congress to get the authorization to use force, which is, I recall, the decision was made in in December.
Then we actually went
to Congress, and the vote was in January. Yeah. You had been in Congress. I remember there was a pretty interesting debate within the administration on that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. What was your view? And talk a little bit about how that decision was made, and also just
lessons
you learned from that in retrospect. Yeah.
There's always been a debate, certainly since the end of World War II, about the authority of the president to commit the force and so forth. And we'd had the War Powers Act adopted in the aftermath of Vietnam. My view was that we had all the authority we needed. We didn't have to go back to Congress. For example, we were party to the United Nations Charter. Article 51 provided for us to go to the aid of a fellow member of the United Nations who was under attack. That had all been ratified in a treaty by the United States Senate. So from a legal standpoint, we had all the authority we needed.
And we'd sent hundreds of thousands of troops over to the region already, so it was a little
odd to say that
we now need authority.
That's right. But the president decided he wanted to go for the vote. Yeah. I think he was right and I was wrong. I think he made the right decision because we won. My main concern I had was that, you know, we'd get a large contingent of troops over there. You'd get the Congress to vote. If you couldn't get it passed, what were you going to do? He later said, and I believe him, he said, I wouldn't have had any choice. I would have had to go anyway on the basis that I already had the legal authority, even though Congress had voted against it. Now, fortunately, that didn't happen. We won, but it was very close.
It was pretty close in the Senate, right?
Senate, we won by about 5 votes. Sam Nunn, who was chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and ordinarily would have been a strong supporter, voted no. Sam told me years later that that was the worst vote he ever made.
Yeah.
I always suspected, and he never said this to me, but I always suspected he was thinking about running for president himself in 92, and that he couldn't get the Democratic nomination if he was sort of a pro-war candidate kind of thing. But in the end, we did prevail, and it was interesting in part because the first thing we did was to get the UN resolution approving it. It may sound kind of backwards, but the way it worked in those days still does. The chairmanship of the UN Security Council rotates among the countries each month. Somebody else chairs the meetings. And I think it was November was our turn. So Jim Baker went up and chaired the meeting. We'd worked very hard and lobbied very hard, the president especially, with the heads of government of all the countries that then had seats on the council. And we were worried about Russia with a veto or China. And in the end, it carried. And with the UN behind it, the Congress could hardly turn us down. I mean, you know, the UN's going to vote for war and the Congress isn't. Not likely. So politically, that's the way we handle it. And it worked very well, and the president made the right call, although it was we cut it a bit close, about 5 votes in the Senate.
Yeah, I guess the Democrats control both houses. I think we went to the House first, right, where there was a bigger margin.
We had a bigger margin.
Less Aspen was for it. But the Senate was. Well, the irony is Al Gore was one of the key deciding Democrats to go for it.
Yeah, that's probably why he got to be vice president.
Isn't that an irony? So Sam Nunn may have decided he couldn't be for it because of his national ambitions, and the guy who actually gets on the ticket and becomes vice president of the United States, actually.
You never know what's going to happen.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, it's an interesting lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a very interesting lesson, Bill Kristol. So I'm sorry. I hope nobody went to sleep during that. To me, it's just fascinating. Dick Cheney, first of all, completely getting it wrong. The United Nations Charter was never ratified as a treaty by a supermajority of the Senate. It was ratified as just a law, the UN Participation Act, by a bare majority of both houses. It's not a treaty. And there's nothing in the treaty power of the Constitution that says, and yes, it says, any treaty entered into is the supreme law of the land, but not over the Constitution itself. The Constitution would then implode in a poof of logic. As though the founders thought for a minute, the only way to amend the Constitution is to have 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the state legislatures all agree to it, or to call for a whole new constitutional convention, or if the president enters into combination with any foreign government and they write a treaty, in which case they can rewrite any part of the Constitution they want. Oh, yeah, really. Good argument, Democrats. I mean, conservative Republican Dick Cheney, right-wing nationalist. And then he also says they went to the UN first to corner the Congress and make them do it. And then, of course, if Congress had said no, they would have invaded anyway. You gotta love Dick Cheney, man. I mean, hate his guts. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I've got some clips. I ain't done yet. Actually, not by a bit. Tomorrow I'll have more. These clips are from William Crystal's interview with Dick Cheney. That thing's 2 hours long. It's incredible. As I pointed out on the show yesterday, most notable thing about it is they don't talk about the Iraq War at all. They don't talk about it at all. The first Iraq War, they talk about. The second Iraq War, that in and out of government, these two men did the most to cause, other than Bush, the president himself, who actually signed the orders. No mention in a 2 hour long interview in which they talk all about the greatness of Gerald Ford and on and on and on. No time at all for their signature achievement, the invasion and occupation of Iraq. These two guys. Anyway, so far, a couple of oblique references to the importance of putting troops on the Arabian Peninsula, which is the number one cause of the terrorist war against the United States, other than our support for Israel's endless war against the civilians of Lebanon and Palestine. And then Cheney more or less correctly describing Saddam Hussein's gripe, although, of course, leaving out how, because America put him up to it and then left him high and dry and then baited him into overreacting and stabbed their friend in the back and got another 1.5 million people killed. Anyway, Cheney's promise to the Saudi king to leave Saudi Arabia. That was his reference. Importantly. All right, out of order here, Horton, but still. And then the conversation about the war powers. The UN Charter supersedes Article 1, Section 8, says Dick Cheney. And then he also says, even though, because it's a treaty, he specifically says, because it's a treaty ratified by the Senate. But no, it's not. It's not a treaty. The UN Participation Act is not a treaty. And that does, and even if it was a treaty, that doesn't override Article 1, Section 8 anyway. It couldn't possibly. And then, but he says that's all the authority the president needed. And by the way, he didn't need that authority either. Because politically, they decided what they would do is, because it was our turn rotating on the UN Security Council to chair the thing, that we'd ran the thing through the Security Council, get Russia and China to go along and, you know, stay out of it, but allow it. And then we would corner the Congress and say, well, the UN already voted for it, and basically make them do it. But then he said if that didn't work, he said he argued against that. What if Congress votes no? Then what are you going to do? And Bush Sr. decided to go ahead and go to Congress anyway, but he explicitly announced, just for the rubber stamp, I could do this anyway without you. And then he later said, too, that if they had voted no, he would have gone ahead and invaded anyway. Crystal laughs. This is ridiculous. As though you have to go to Congress when the president apparently had all the authority he needed to create the massive buildup in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia for the invasion. But now he needs permission to actually invade with him? I mean, come on. Bill Crystal says. And then they talk about the politics of it. Senator Sam Nunn, thought he wanted to be president, thought if he voted for this war, that would hurt him with the Democrats, and he shouldn't vote for it. That was his only reason, probably was his only reason for voting against it. Al Gore decided, nope, it's a war, I better vote for it. And he got rewarded with the vice presidency because Clinton, the governor of Arkansas, had publicly opposed the war. And so he needed someone to cover his right flank. And so he brought in Al Gore. And of course, Joe Biden and John Kerry voted against the war, the first one we're talking about, 1990. And they never lived it down politically, to their shame. And so they moved further and further to the right their whole lives ever since then, trying to live down their shame of ever opposing a war. These jerks. And then, but so they have a little laugh about that. There's a very important lesson there, I think, intones Bill Kristol. All senators should always support all wars if they want to run for president later. What a very important lesson we've learned. Thank you, guys. And then, now, I won't be able to get to all the terror war stuff. That'll have to wait till tomorrow. But this is my last one, and I don't think I really need to set this up for you too much. It's Bill Kristol interviewing Dick Cheney about the Gerald Ford years, a specific part of his interview with Dick Cheney about the Gerald Ford years.
He tried to save South Vietnam in early 75, but Congress prevented that, I guess. That must have been a very rough week or two or month or so. And
Vietnam,
to be in the White House watching the helicopters taking off, and feeling that you wanted to do something but had been stopped, that must have been very difficult, I should think.
He had the arrangement by then, all the U.S. forces are out, and this is the spring of 75.
Right.
And the North has invaded the South, basically. We had still had people at the embassy in Saigon and still had a contingent. We were flying people out of, especially orphans, out of Dan Sanut there in Saigon. It was a difficult, dark period of time, and the president had the authority to go ask Congress for additional help. And the way Nixon had handled the withdrawal before was pretty much a commitment to the South Vietnamese that if they got into difficulty, we would we'd support them.
Especially a flat-out North Vietnamese invasion, contrary to the treaty.
Exactly.
The treaty. Yeah.
So, but Congress shot that down. I can remember being down at Tulane University in Louisiana when the president was making a speech down there, and that was the day that it sort of all got – that was clear there wasn't going to be any further involvement by the U.S. And then we ended up back up here – the West Wing, there was a state dinner underway that night, but this is the night that the embassy was surrounded by Viet Cong and by the North Vietnamese. We'd been told by our ambassador on the scene through Jim Schlesinger, over defense, Secretary of Defense, that all the Americans were out, when in fact they weren't. We still had 50 Marines on the ground surrounding the embassy trying to secure it while we're lifting people off by a helicopter from the embassy roof. Eventually got that sorted out, but then there was no shortage of difficulties. Mayaguez occurred a couple of weeks later. Okay. An American merchant ship captured on the high seas by Cambodian rebels.
During this time, you're deputy Rumsfeld, chief of staff.
I was the deputy until the fall of 75.
Kissinger is still...
All right, so there you go. Anyway, they're changing the subject at that point. That's Bill Kristol and Dick Cheney on the fall of Saigon and the invasion of the South by the North. The Americans had officially withdrawn. 2 weeks later, the North Vietnamese army just walked into the South and took Saigon. And so here are these two coward warmongers crying their eyes out that Gerald Ford, I guess, didn't just elbow the Congress aside and reinvade South Vietnam. Hey, North Vietnam, you promised not to invade the South. So reinvade. Dick Cheney, who had 5 draft deferments. Boy, Bill Kristol says, you must have really wanted to do something. Yes, do something. This guy who... his college career, his marriage, his children can be directly correlated to his excuses that he needed to get out of fighting in Vietnam. This soft-handed warmonger, sissy, Dick Cheney. And Bill Kristol, too. He was of age then. I don't know his story of how all he got out of it. But Dick Cheney was asked on the record, well, how come he didn't go fight in Vietnam? He said, I had other priorities at the time. You go die. Hey, all Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. So again, if you want to read that whole thing or watch that whole thing, it's Bill Kristol interviews Dick Cheney. Just Google it, it'll come right up. But it's conversationswithbillkristol.org, I think, is the website. Something like that. Easy enough to find. 2-hour interview. I read the whole damn thing. I don't know if you got the stomach for it or not. Lots of little gems in there, if you like digging between lines. And a lot of frank admissions, too, from a psychopath to a one of the worst fawning Smithers in all of America, Bill Kristol. Boy, that Bill Kristol is something else. You know how he does it? He just never stops smiling. He just never stops smiling. Hey, everybody, let's kill all the Iraqis until they're all dead. And everybody just goes, I guess you make a compelling case, dude. You seem very self-possessed, you know? All right, well. So, moving on. I will get back to that tomorrow. I did not have a chance this morning. I did. I just didn't take the chance this morning to get all the sound bites I needed. And then by the time I got started, I ran out of time to finish. But I do have more quotes from Cheney that I want to just make sure that I have saved in audio format for playing later for historical purposes kind of a thing. And maybe dead air filler if I need some. But yeah, a little bit of torture, a little bit of terror war. A few more sound bites for tomorrow's show. You can go read the whole thing. I had a conversation with Bill Kristol. All right, so during the break, I got an email from a guy who said, well, he's arguing with his pro-Hillary friends about Hillary, that she's a bad guy, dude. And then so people say that, no way, man, we like her, because they've chosen their team. This poor guy, Josh, living among people who like Hillary. Ugh, makes me feel yucky just saying it. But anyway, he says, so is she really that bad? Where's that quote again, where she urged Bill Clinton to start the Kosovo War? Why, that's in Gail Sheehy's authorized biography, a direct quote from Hillary Clinton, I urged Bill to bomb. And in context, you see that this was really when they first started talking again after the impeachment and impeachment trial in the Senate. This was how they made up, was over a war in 1999. She told Bill Clinton, why are you not bombing? Start bombing now. And he said, yes, dear. I always thought that was just him bragging. That was his victory lap for not being removed from office. No, that was his tribute to his wife. That was like getting her a new gold necklace. He got her a war. Those Clintons are sick. And then he also asked, and what was this about Hillary wanted to do Libya? Oh, yeah. Hillary wanted to do Libya. After the Arab Spring, it was so obvious to all 7 billion people in the world, including 300 million Americans, that, wow, wait, so it's America's best friends are the evil, ruthless tyrants that are being overthrown in these popular revolutions of decent men and women in the streets chanting for a modicum of fair play and justice and enough bread to eat, huh? I wonder if I'm learning something today. The Americans began to start to think to themselves, and so Hillary needed a PR stunt. And I called it way in advance, and Michael Hastings, and yes, there's more to it than that. Sarkozy had his interests. The Brits had their interests. The oil companies have their interests. And the Pentagon always wants to bomb something. And the neocons always did hate Gaddafi. The Saudis hated Gaddafi. But Hillary's thing was she needed a PR stunt. It was too clear that America backed every king and potentate and sultan and emir in the region other than dictator Assad and dictator Khamenei. The rest of them, all American sock puppets in the entire region. And, you know, Assad did work for Clinton and Bush torturing people to death. It's just he wasn't outright a sock puppet. He was just, you know, useful sometimes, but not really in American orbit. But anyway, so they decided that Gaddafi was expendable for a PR stunt. That's all it was. They stabbed him in the back for a PR stunt. And yes, in the back because he had been brought in from the cold in 2003. Bush needed a PR stunt to pretend that the war in Iraq had achieved anything. So the narrative was cooked up that it frightened Gaddafi into giving up his nuclear program. Well, he had no nuclear program. He just had a bunch of old junk that he bought at AQ Khan's garage sale just so he could give it up. He'd been trying to kiss America's ass and enter back in, you know, be brought in from the cold and all that kind of crap, like they say, since 1996. You can read Gary Hart in the New York Times Magazine all about it. 1996, he was in Athens, Greece, and one of Gaddafi's guys came up to him and said, "Please, we'll do anything to be okay again with you guys." Way back. But anyway, so Bush needed a PR stunt. They finally brought him in from the cold in 2003, and we're making friends with him again. You can read John McCain's tweets about hanging out with Gaddafi in 2009. He was there with Lieberman and Graham trying to sell him armored personnel carriers and training for his troops and to broker deals through the Brits because the American laws were getting in the way. You can read all about it, and the Boston Globe did good coverage of this. It's there. Just look up McCain and his friendship with Gaddafi just 2 years before McCain became the lead cheerleader for overthrowing him, along with Hillary. Oh, but then here's the footnotes. Michael Hastings in Rolling Stone wrote all about how it was Samantha Power, because she was tired of doing do-gooder, rinky-dink stuff. She'd been exiled to the lower rungs of the National Security Council for insulting Her Highness Hillary Clinton. And this was her chance to make up with Hillary and to get some attention and some power from Obama. And so she said, "Let's kill Gaddafi." And she got Susan Rice to join her, and they went to Hillary and said, "Please, let's all three go to Obama and see if we can do this." And they did. And they convinced him to overrule Gates, Robert Gates, the Republican Secretary of Defense, the guy who presided over the surge failure, escalation failure in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he said, "No, don't do it." And, whoa, what the hell is that? Jesus, that one sounded closer. Did you guys hear that? It sounds like there's a gigantic balloon in another dimension right next to my head. I got it recorded that time. I saw the blip on the thing. You might think I was hallucinating those crazy noises. Something electronic. There's nothing smoking. God dang. Sounded like maybe it was inside the microphone. It was so close. Huh. Still works, though. Huh. I don't know enough about electronics to know what the hell that was. Sure sounded like somebody shooting me in the head, though, didn't it? Like with a 22 or a 38 or something? Crap. Anyway, and then the other great footnote is, I forgot who wrote it, but it's at the Daily Beast. Does he call them the three Valkyries of the apocalypse or something like that? But it's at the Daily Beast, which is Newsweek, very official mainstream source. And it's about the three women. Just type in three women, Hillary, Gaddafi, Libya, 2011. You'll find it. It's in there. And never mind all she did to monger us into war with Iraq in 03. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show here from noon to 3 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network, scotthorton.org for all the archives. Join up the chat room at Scott Horton Show. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. scotthorton.org/chat. That's what I meant to say. Oh, slash Scott Horton Show. That would be my Twitter feed. Hashtag Scott Horton Show is the IRC free node address there. But just go to scotthorton.org/chat, a fake name and a CAPTCHA, and you're in. Now, have you guys ever read A Foreign Policy of Freedom by Ron Paul? It's really great. So what it is it's a collection of all of his foreign policy speeches from, say, 1973, I think, or 78 or something. Maybe it was, yeah, later 70s, 76, something. Through, I don't know, I guess 2003 or something like that, the Iraq War stuff. I'm not sure exactly. Yeah. Anyway, space, no, nah, maybe later than that, through 05 or something. It's a lifetime worth of foreign policy speeches, all of them on the floor of the House of Representatives. Not every speech he ever gave about foreign policy, just from the floor of the House of Representatives. The speeches of Congressman Ron Paul on foreign policy, a foreign policy of freedom. It's great. He does start out a little bit right-wing on China and stuff like this, but nah, he ends up great on everything, just great. And but anyway, so here's the thing. He was in the House of Representatives, our friend Ron Paul, back in 1983 when Reagan put the troops in Lebanon. And there's a series of speeches in A Foreign Policy of Freedom by Ron Paul all about what happens in Lebanon. And Anthony Gregory actually wrote an essay once reviewing the book, and he sums this up basically perfectly. I should give him the credit here. And I'm now roughly paraphrasing Gregory, roughly paraphrasing this series of speeches by Ron Paul. Mr. Reagan, don't do it. Don't put troops in Beirut. It's a problem. We don't belong there. The whole thing's confusing. We're now protecting the PLO from our allies, the Israelis. This is kind of crazy. I don't think. And then the next speech is, Mr. Reagan, now that you put our troops in Beirut, I beseech you, get the troops out of Lebanon. We should not have Marines in Lebanon. There's no business over there. This can only escalate and lead to more trouble. And what possible good end could they achieve of being stationed there? And I'm just warning you, something bad is going to happen. And then the next speech is, Mr. Reagan, I told you something bad was going to happen. Now 283 Marines have been killed, and all these Frenchmen and whoever else is there too, killed in this massive attack on our barracks. And will you please now just get out and recognize the truth of the situation? You could get mad and go in there and smash, but who are you going to get? Just stop right now, man. It's the wrong thing. Just get out, Mr. President, said Ron Paul. And then in his next speech, he says, glory, hallelujah. Ronald Reagan, you listened to reason and you pulled the Marines out of Lebanon instead of doubling down. Thank goodness that you've done the right thing after doing the wrong thing and learning your lesson the hard way. Whew, this could have been so much worse. And then that's the happy ending to the Lebanon story from it could have got much worse in American intervention's point of view anyway. Obviously, it's not like the CIA left forever or anything. Don't get me wrong, but obviously, you know what I mean. So that's the series of speeches. Don't do it. Oh, no, you did it. Get out before it's too late. Oh, no, something bad happened. Still get out before it gets worse. Hooray, you did the right thing and got out. That's how I should have paraphrased it. But now I've double paraphrased it, so now you get it. And Ron Paul to this day, as in his recent interview with Larry King, which I think you'll really like if you watch it, he again cites Ronald Reagan's memoirs, where he said that Middle Eastern politics are so irrational that he decided that there's just no point in trying to iron this out. There's nothing to iron out. It is a boiling cauldron. Just stay the hell away. That was the lesson Reagan learned, and so Ron Paul loves to invoke that. That, look, Ronald Reagan, the standard for American tough guy politician who stood down the Soviet Union and all this kind of crap, right? He says, no, it's perfectly okay to stop doing the wrong thing if what you're doing is the wrong thing. That's called being smart. Nothing weak about it. Just knock it off and start acting right. It'll be all right. Ron Paul likes to invoke that. So now, I could only get you about probably 2% of the way to understand and how complicated Middle Eastern politics are. But, you know, I think that it's the Americans who are the most irrational of all. Where America, almost first and foremost, hates Iran for daring to overthrow the American-backed sock puppet dictatorship of the Shah Reza Pahlavi in 1979 and taking the hostages and humiliating the United States and declaring independence in the how rude way that they did that the Americans can't stand. And yet America just fought an 8-year war for Iran in Iraq, gave them Iraq on a golden platter. Well, all the land from Baghdad to Basra, and that's their interest, is keeping that. And that's what their interest has been for the last 11 years. Longer in Iraq, has taken all the land from Baghdad to Basra and using their sock puppet militias, and that includes the American Army and Marine Corps, to do it and turning Sunnistan free. Now, of course, Iran's other biggest enemies in the world are the Israelis and the Saudis, and they also hate Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who, even though he's allied, obviously, with the Shiites, being an Alawite, which is sort of kind of a break-off of Shiism, even though it sort of pre-exists Shiite Islam, too. But anyway, it's kind of a complicated thing that I don't really understand. But anyway, it's the Alawite-Shiite-Christian coalition behind the non-Islamist, clean-shaven-chin, secular, three-piece suit-wearing dictator Bashar al-Assad. As mean as he is, he's not a bin Ladenite. But he's friends with the Russians, and he's friends with the Iranians, and he's friends with Hezbollah, which has the defensive ability to keep Israel out of southern Lebanon. And that is an offensive threat to the Israelis from their point of view, of course. And they're just absolutely obsessed with the Iranians. And yet it was the Israelis who pushed for the Iraq war as much as anybody else. The consequence of Iran being empowered by that war is blowback for them as bad as it's blowback for us. But then, so it's our other best allies in Saudi Arabia, who, along with the Turks and the Qataris, and with a lot of American acquiescence here, who have been arming and funding and backing, well, first, the Saudis really did back the Sunni-based insurgency against the Americans and their Shiite allies in the Iraq War. That wasn't covered too much, but on this show it was. As Greg Pallas put it, it was a proxy war between Saudi and Iran really the whole time. Well, certainly in the latest chapter, the Saudis have backed the Mujahideen in Libya, down even into Mali, and backed them in Syria. And here, these are the guys who, at least up until 2013, just a year and a few months ago, a year and a half ago, I guess, were sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri and the al-Nusra Front, the Iraqi and Syrian veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, working together to fight against Assad. And here, America and its allies are backing the American people's enemies, because Israel and Saudi's enemies are the Baathists in Syria and the mullahs in Iran, even though they haven't actually ever done anything for us. Again, Bashar al-Assad was not really the sock puppet, but was the loyal torturer, murderer, assassin of Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, including, you know, tortured innocent people for Bush, who had nothing to do with anything but just happened to be kidnapped by the CIA and sent to Assad, as Robert Baer, the famous CIA, CNN analyst, former CIA agent, says. When we would kidnap people, if we wanted them to be tortured, if we wanted them to be tortured, we'd send them to Assad. If we wanted them to disappear, we'd send them to Mubarak down in Egypt. But anyway, and so now, and America backs the Kurds in Iraq, but also their enemies, the Turks. And, 1%. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys. So, as I remind you every day on the show, what the war really accomplished, Iraq War II, was giving Baghdad to the Shia at the expense of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dead people, a society smashed, a million families destroyed, everything ruined, and 4,500 Americans killed, tens of thousands wounded, and so that was the real effect of that. And what happened in doing so, though, is that the Sunni side rallied around kooks like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the founder of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they rallied around people like the Badr Brigade on the Shiite side. And so what ended up happening was the sectarian difference was basically, you know, a sides-of-town difference, a class difference, a political difference, an earthly difference. Who belongs to what sect was a matter of identity, not a matter of blasphemy. But what ended up happening through 8 years' worth of chaos is, well, the cruelest and most radical sons of bitches end up, as the war nerd says, the ruthless killers who bide their time in the shadows, they end up rising to the top. Well, you know, Jihadi, the dumbass wannabe hero, goes out there and gets his head blown off. The real bad guys that you got to look out for are the ones that you can't see, that are sitting there mean enough and smart enough to stay alive in an environment like this. And these guys, Zarqawi as the prime example on the Sunni side, they're hell-bent on sectarian war. That wasn't what bin Laden wanted. Bin Laden wanted to portray America's war as against all of Islam, and all of Islam should be against them. But in the Iraq War, it was a sectarian deal to begin with, so Zarqawi just showed up and became the very worst part of that, and helped to solidify this thing as a sectarian war, where Shia then are apostates and blasphemers and the worst kinds of traitors to God and this kind of thing, they become intolerable from that point of view. And then the Shiites, of course, I don't know exactly how religious the leadership of the Badr Brigade is, but you could see how they inspire religion in their enemies, because they are the most brutal torturer murderers America's backed since, well, Ronald Reagan backed Saddam Hussein. They're just absolutely out of control, these guys. And so George Bush's war became not just a sectarian war in terms of power politics, who's who and who rules what and who gets what money and what resources and what gain and what land, but it has become a religious sectarian war in many ways. And so any part of the war that we participate in now, any side we take, takes on all those dimensions. So if America's flying cover for the Iranian government, aka the Quds Force, aka the Iraqi government, its army that George Bush trained up, what's left of it, and the Shiite militias, then we are fighting for the Ayatollah Sistani and the Ayatollah Khamenei and the horrible Shia apostates. That's in scare quotes, if you can't hear in my tone of voice. Against these hardcore Sunni Islamist kooks who would love to portray it that way. That they are under attack from the Persians, the Iranians, the Shia. And all with the help of the apostate crusader Christians from North America. It's perfect for what they need in terms of public relations. And I think they probably have anticipated from the beginning, from declaring a caliphate, that the Americans would come back and that they would be driven back underground and back into an insurgency. And they can do this all day. That's at least the, you know, and I understand why you'd be cynical about this kind of thing. I guess I am too. I mean, these guys are all just politicians. Certainly what they want us to believe, this guy Baghdadi, when he walks around with a suicide belt on, is that, wow, he really means it, and he's really willing to set that thing off at any time. Now, maybe he's not. Maybe he just wants a harem and a bunch of riches to lie around in and that kind of thing, but kind of doesn't seem like it. Kind of seems more like these guys are in it for the long haul, and they're perfectly happy to have the Americans reinvade. That goes right along with the strategy all along. It was the withdrawal that broke from bin Laden's plan. Going back is just perfect. They want to, as Michael Scheuer keeps trying to beg you to listen to him to understand, they want us to stay so that then we'll leave forever. They want to bog us down. If it takes a generation, if it takes a century, if it takes 10 million more killed over there, they want to bog us down, bleed our empire to bankruptcy, and then force it all the way out. Only then, they say, can they have their way. And America here, in intervening, especially on the side of the Iranians, on the side of their Syrian allies, are basically just playing right into their hands. Now, the Kurds, I don't know, man. They're Sunnis, too. They're a different ethnicity. They're not Arabs, but I don't think the caliphate is so much racist that way. But they're certainly enemies with the PKK commies. I don't know if they can reach some kind of treaty-type deal with the Kurdish Peshmerga and the Kurdish state up there in the Barzani-Talibani coalition in northern Iraq. Maybe they can. Maybe they're going to have to fight like hell for Kirkuk. But that seems like much more human battles than sectarian ones there, as far as I know. But anyway, you could see why American intervention in this war can only make matters worse. All the way around. The fight really belongs to, if you look at a map, you'll see they're surrounded by enemies. The Shia and the Iranians, the Kurds, the Turks. Well, the Turks aren't their enemies, but the Turks certainly have the ability to contain them and keep them out. They don't want to help them expand north into Turkey, and certainly can prevent that. And then you have Assad in Syria. You got the Jordanian military, which can keep them out of Jordan. And then Egypt and Saudi, I think, are just too far from there anyway. But those are both, of course, compliant regimes to a point, whatever, that certainly would fight to keep them out of Sinai or to keep them out of, you know, some kind of advance on Riyadh or anything like that. No danger of that. They're landlocked and by enemies. They have no foreign trade that's not black market trade with the Turks, our allies, so we ought to be able to clamp down on that, or at least, you know, as much as you can in a situation like this, which is a lot more than what they're doing. But the fight belongs to the Sunni populations of what used to be Iraq and Syria, the new Islamic State. Is that what they want? Omar Abu Bakr Baghdadi, whatever, and his totalitarian enforcement police? Or would they rather have their traditional tribal system? And what do the tribal leaders say about this? And how much relative power do they have? I think we saw in 2006 that tribes can kick Al-Qaeda's ass. Now, Al-Qaeda learned that too, and they've taken precautions this time around, as Patrick Coburn has explained on this show very well. They've taken measures to make sure they're not stabbed in the back, but still, they're far outnumbered. The reason that the tribes and the Baathists have allied with them is basically for protection from the Shia, to use their power to declare independence and go ahead and move on with the next phase of post-Iraqi life over there. But that doesn't mean that they're going to put up with these guys forever. And if you look, just go back and look at 2006, before Petraeus got the mandate to surge into Iraq in 2007, all through 2006, local Sunni tribal guys and just regular Iraqi Sunni, whoever they were shooting their Al-Qaeda's so-called helpers. Tired of your help, now I'm going to shoot you in the face with a bullet, they would say. You know, in Iraqi dialect Arabic. And they were marginalizing these guys bad before Petraeus ever came to town and did the awakening. And that's the only solution to this thing that is going to lead to a balance of power that can last. Because even if you could arm up the Kurds with every bit of weaponry you dare to give them, and all the air cover you dare to give them and whatever, to go in and sack Mosul, blast the hell out of it, and drive the Islamic State out of there. One, you still only turn them into an insurgency, and two, you're now backing an alien force occupying Mosul, Tikrit, Fallujah, whichever. Assuming that you could even get the Kurds to do that, assuming they had the capability to do that, and that's not a sustainable situation. Again, backing the Iranians and their Shiite militias, that'll blow up right in your face and make matters worse. Just knock it off, America. You started it all anyway.